Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a writer, human rights activist, and former Ironman triathlete puts all of her passions together to write a compelling first novel. Naomi Benaron knew she wanted to write about Rwanda from the first time she laid eyes on its landscape, a landscape so beautiful it seemed to veil tragic and horrific events. Of course, in 1994, it's believed that upwards of 800,000 Rwandans died during the genocide of that year. With Benaron's own family history touched by genocide, in her case, the Holocaust, Running the Rift was the story that had to be told. The novel follows a young academic and runner, Jean-Patrick Nakuba, a Tutsi who's on the verge of achieving his dream of running in the 1996 Atlanta Olympics to represent both Rwanda, his family, and his Tutsi culture. But as tensions mount between the politically manipulated Hutus and Tutsis, Jean-Patrick falls prey to that false hope of "this can't happen here." Running the Rift tells a story of how years of pitting neighbor versus neighbor, first by colonials and later by unscrupulous leaders, caused tensions to boil. It also shares her passion for running and her true love of the Rwandan people, both Hutu and Tutsi, as she tries to understand the moment of madness along the Albertine Rift. Running the Rift won the 2011 Bellwether Prize for socially engaged fiction and has just come out in softcover back in October. Naomi Benaron is my guest today. Naomi Benaron, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book, Running the Rift, is a wonderful book telling the story of Jean-Patrick Nakuba during a horrific time in African history. And you said this book began 8 years after the genocide with a trip to Rwanda. What was remarkable about that trip?
The first thing that was remarkable, I went as a tourist with my dog trainer, actually. It was a whole serendipitous series of events. But just flying over the country, I was so struck by its beauty. It's probably the greenest country, well, outside of Ireland, but I hadn't been to Ireland yet. But it's one of the greenest countries I've ever seen in my life. And you just come down, we were coming in a small plane, and this country with these amazing hills. Rwanda is called the Land of a Thousand Hills. And you just, it's like these rolling, beautiful, steep hills just rising out of the mist, and the sun was just coming up. And then we got on the ground, and you can see that all these hills are actually terraced. This is where the women go. Every morning they climb the hills with their baskets and they tend their fields. This is everything's farm. This is their farmland up on these really steep hills. And then I was struck, the people are just the friendliest, nicest people. They were so open, and I knew a little bit about the genocide, not that much at the time. I knew what we all knew, which was essentially that all these people were killed and in a very short space of time. And to see how open they were and how generous, if they have two cups of tea, they will give you a cup of tea. So that was the first thing that really struck me, was the generosity and the open spirit of the people. And if you ever see pictures of people in Rwanda, they have the most gorgeous smiles you can imagine. And then I was walking on the shores of Lake Kivu, which is, it forms the boundary between Rwanda and Congo. And at the time, Kigali was coming out of the genocide, but the countryside was really still, it seemed like a war zone going through that countryside. There were buildings with bullet holes in the walls, and some buildings where just a single wall remained. And so I was walking on the shores of the lake, and my foot hit something hard, and I bent down, and it turned out to be a human bone.
Wow.
And then I got down on my hands and knees, and I was looking through the sand. It's this really beautiful black volcanic sand. There's right across the border in Goma, there is a volcano, active volcano, Mount Nyiragongo, and it had gone off fairly recently, actually. But so I'm in the sand, and I see there are bones and teeth all scattered through the sand. So I picked up a handful of bones and teeth, and I held them in my hands, and I had this sudden revelation that these weren't just bones, they were stories, and that if someone else didn't honor those stories, they would be lost forever. And that was the moment I really decided to write about Rwanda.
And those two contrasting images, how incongruous.
Yeah. I know.
And, I mean, you described this paradise and yet at the same time a hell.
Yeah.
And, of course, that is the foundation of the book, that this society that was so, neighbor turned on neighbor in this, just these short, crazy years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Except that it had been a long time coming.
Yeah. Now, for those who don't remember, you know, we know that around 1 million people died during the Rwandan genocide in 1994. The best guess is about 800,000. But beyond that, most Americans really don't know much other than the Hutus were the majority people. They had been out of power until just within the last 20 years. The Tutsi were the minority, and they had traditionally ruled the area through colonial years and even prior to that, before European powers came to Africa. So there was always this tension, but it really didn't manifest itself until right around 1990, or it seemed to. What did you find as you began researching Rwandan history?
I think the tensions really began when the Belgians came in, which the Belgians were, quote-unquote, given Rwanda and Burundi, that region of East Africa after World War One, and before that it had, quote-unquote, belonged to, I'm talking in colonial terms, the Germans, who really had no interest there. But King Leopold, who was not a very nice man, he was the ruler of Belgium, and he came in and decided that because the land is so fertile, that this would be a good place to have tea plantations and actually pyrethrin. There were a lot of pyrethrin plantations. So with the colonial wisdom, he decided in divide and conquer. And before the Belgians came in, distinctions between Hutu and Tutsi were very fluid. They are essentially the same people. They're not really two tribes. They have the same clan system. They have the same religion. Well, now they're Christian, but before Christianity, they had shared the same animist religion. They have the same language, the same origin myths. So the Tutsi traditionally are physically different. They're a tall, thin, lighter people. Nilotics probably initially came down from Ethiopia, but they've been in this region for a long time. And there's been so much intermarriage between the Hutu and Tutsi that even when the Belgians came, it was really difficult to tell for the majority of people if they were Hutu or Tutsi. And as I said, boundaries were fluid. If you had the Tutsi were the keeper of the cattle. So if you had a certain amount of cattle, you could become Tutsi. If you married a Tutsi, you could become Tutsi. Then the Belgians came in and they said, well, we're going to issue these identity cards in Ndangamutu in Kinyarwanda, which is the language they speak. And they did crazy things like measure people. They had calipers, and they would measure people's noses. And if your nose was thinner than a certain dimension, they would put it in your identity card that you were Tutsi, and if you had a broader nose, you were Hutu. And once it was written in that card, it was written in stone, so to speak. You couldn't change it. And it was these identity cards that were used in 1994 to determine if you made it alive through a roadblock or out of a school or if you had gone there.
It was really arbitrary divisions then that were created through colonialism.
Exactly. And initially when the Belgians came in, they set up the Tutsi, because the Tutsi had been the ruling class. You know, the king, the Mwami, was Tutsi. The warriors were Tutsi. So they set up the Tutsi as their overseers. You know, they were the ones who meted out the punishment. If the Hutu were kind of the people, they built the roads and they did the essentially slave labor for the Belgians.
They created a caste system.
Exactly. And the Tutsi were in charge of them, and the Belgians instructed the Tutsi to beat the Hutu or they and their families would be beaten. So you're creating all this resentment. And then I think it was, I always get the year exactly mixed up, but around 58, The Hutu rose up against the Tutsi, and they kicked the Mwami out. And the Belgians said, well, I think we really want to be on the winning side here, so we're going to support the Hutu. We want the Hutu to be in charge, which is interesting, too, because Rwanda and when the Belgians came into the region, Rwanda and Burundi were one area together, and it was really, I think the Belgians were the ones who divided that area into two countries, and in Burundi, the Tutsi remained in charge, but after 58, the Hutu were in charge in Rwanda, and they remained in charge, and there were episodes of genocide before 94, and the noose was kind of tightening against the Tutsi. Propaganda was increasing against the Tutsi until in 1991 was the start of a civil war. The diaspora Tutsi, many of them who in earlier episodes of violence had fled to Uganda, and many of those people were trained in the Ugandan army, and Kagame, who is now the president of Rwanda, he was one of them. And they came down in 1991 because they had wanted the right to return to Rwanda, and they were not being given that right. So they took possession of this town called Ruhengeri in the north. They were quickly beaten back, but that was the start of the civil war.
Oh. And with that became, there was a drumbeat of a Hutu nationalism.
Yes.
The radio and television, which plays a role in the book, you know, they're basically are encouraging people to kill Tutsis, really.
Yeah.
In the book, you write that. And give us a sense of how you began to learn this history, because you have your own background, your family background. Your mother escaped the Holocaust mm-hmm. through Switzerland and then eventually settled in Canada. So this sort of story of escaping genocide is a personal story, but how did you learn about Rwandan society to be able to write this book?
I really, as I said, knew nothing when I started, and I initially was doing internet searches, and I found this amazing man, Professor Alexandre Kimani, who taught at Sacramento State University, and then I met his wife, Mathilde Mukantabana, and they became very close friends, and their help was invaluable in writing the novel. They were always available to help me with personal questions and with more cultural questions. So that's how my search began. And then I just started reading everything. I made three more trips to Rwanda, and I would stay about a month each time. And I ended up becoming quite close to Mathilde's family in Rwanda, and I would stay with them. So I learned a lot about culture through them. And then there's this amazing book. It's, I don't know, probably 1,000 pages or so, written by Alison DeForge in Human Rights Watch, and it's called Leave None to Tell the Story. And that gives the history of Rwanda from pre-colonial times up through the genocide. And that was an invaluable resource as well.
Well, you chose to tell the story through this character, Jean-Patrick Nkuba, who is a runner. You're a runner yourself, a former triathlete and still avid runner. Why choose to tell this story through a runner? What was your mindset in choosing that as your protagonist?
I think in some sense, it wasn't even a choice. It just happened because, you know, I have certain things that make it into a lot of my fiction. And one is athletic endeavors and running, or since I'm a triathlete, not so much biking, because that's my least favorite, but I've had swimmers in my stories, I've had runners. Running is my favorite. I started as a runner, and then I got into swimming and then biking when I was injured. But I think because I was writing about a culture that was so completely foreign to me, that I gave Jean-Patrick two characteristics from my soul so that I could understand him. Because when I write about a character, I have to be able to get inside his or her mind and soul. So I think that running transcends culture, clearly. I mean, look at all the African runners who who are winning at every distance now, male and female. And the other thing is that I spent so many years as a scientist, so I gave Jean-Patrick the love and passion for science, kind of as a way to, for me, science is a way to make sense out of this crazy world. And so that's how I think Jean-Patrick also saw the world, is through this lens of the order of science.
And Jean-Patrick in the book is a Tutsi. He has always been running. He's from a very young age. At the beginning of the book, you see some of the tensions that you were alluding to prior to the early 1990s. But by the time 1994 rolls around, he's on his way towards hopefully becoming an Olympic athlete, going to Atlanta and making progress. He's probably very close to world-class status. And this is occurring. You know, I know some reviewers have said there's a little bit too much running for their taste. I actually found it very interesting, because I'm not a runner myself, but I would think that running is such a solitary activity that your mind goes to interesting places while you're training, while you're running.
Absolutely. I actually, some of the best moments, I think, in my book came to me when I was running.
Give us a sense.
Well, a couple of the moments I can't really talk too much about because they give something away, but I'll just say there's a coach in the book.
Yes.
Who is a Hutu, and it's interesting because he was the one character that came to me fully formed. I never had to wrestle with who he was. I knew exactly who he was. And his fate came to me while I was running, and I saw the whole thing playing out, and I just had to kind of stop and take a deep breath because it was so clear and so vivid in my mind.
Yeah, so you've already sort of opened the door by saying that that Jean-Patrick is Tutsi and he is a Hutu, but but throughout the book until a particular moment, you would never really know that. I think that gets at the central relationship of what happened during this genocide. I mean, as I was reading through this, I've read a lot more about the similar ethnic battles in Yugoslavia, which was happening about the same time.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, you know, what was going on in our world where all of a sudden people who, you know, saw each other on the street every day, perhaps one man a postman, the other receiving the mail, people working and living together every day, all of a sudden everything breaks apart based on some arbitrary differences, and all of a sudden you're mortal enemies. That just strikes me as, well, such a period of insanity, really.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of these problems are really universal and transcend time periods. I mean, you can see the same things during the Holocaust. I know my own family, my grandfather in 1937, 38 was writing to his relatives in Germany and that area of Bukovina, which is where my family was from, and he was saying, "I can help you get out. You have to get out. Hitler is very dangerous." And my relatives, I mean, this is like his brothers and sisters saying, "Don't worry, Hitler is just crazy, and we're secular Jews, and our neighbors accept us for who we are, and we're Germans, or we're Czechs, we're not Jews." And I think you heard that a lot, and clearly that was erroneous thinking. And, you know, now I think in some ways you're seeing the same thing again in Syria,
true,
where you can really, a lot of it is kind of Sunni-Shia clashes. So I think it just never, sadly, never goes away.
Yeah. My guest today is Naomi Benaron. If you just joined us, she teaches the UCLA Extension Writers Program. She's also a social activist, a mentor for the Afghan Women's Writing Project, worked with genocide survivor groups, and the author of Running the Rift, a novel which is now out in paperback from Algonquin. It won the 2011 Bellwether Prize for Fiction, which is the best book that combines a novel with social activism, and it is a compelling story set against the Rwandan genocide of 1994 through the character of Jean-Patrick Nkuba, who is a world-class 800-meter runner. And the title, Running the Rift, is kind of interesting because, you know, rift has several different, has a geologic meaning. And in fact, yeah, there is a rift that runs through Rwanda. Exactly. And also the rift between Hutu and Tutsi. How did that title come to you, and why was that important?
You know, it's funny because I cannot remember the moment that the title came to me. It had a really, the book in the early draft had a really barfy title, which I'm not even going to repeat, but it was very sentimental. It was horrible. And then I thought, well, this will never do. And I know I was struggling and struggling. I'd like to say that the title came to me when I was running, and it's possible, but I have no idea. But I know that once I found it, I said, that's it. Because I was a geologist, a geophysicist, and geology is really important to me as a metaphor for what goes on in the world. And to think of, because you do have the Albertine Rift that kind of goes through that portion of East Africa, and literally the crust is splitting apart beneath the surface. It's thinning, it's heating up, and I thought that what an incredible metaphor, truly, for what was going on in Rwanda and what goes on in so many parts of Africa and, of course, in the rest of the world, too. But so there was that whole, I loved the double meaning of rift. Mm-hmm. And then thinking about the different levels of running, because in many ways, Jean-Patrick is physically a runner, but he's also running away from the politics of the country. He is one of those people who says, don't worry, you know, everything will be fine, and I don't want to think, he says, he has a politically active girlfriend, and she keeps trying to get him involved in politics, and his reaction is just leave me alone. I want to run and I want to study and that's my world. And of course, as it turns out in Rwanda, that kind of separation was not possible.
Mm. Now you first visited in 2002. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that as you would drive through the countryside, you would see remnants of civil war and of yeah, civil strife. But among the people themselves, have they come to an accommodation? Because it sounds almost like they have in many ways.
It's a really complicated question. I think in many ways they have, or at least they're struggling to come to terms with it and to live together. There's more hope, I think, with the young people. The President Kagame has put a lot of emphasis on education, and also on bringing the country out of those conditions that make fertile ground for genocide happening, such as poverty. He's educating the people. He's really done a lot to promote small businesses. And a lot of so many of the men were killed. There's this huge population of widowed women, and there are a lot of cottage industries now in Rwanda, and you can go to Macy's or I think even Target and I think Costco in some areas. You can buy handicrafts from Rwanda, and I encourage people to do that. They're beautiful. They're beautiful. Mm-hmm. I have them all over my house, baskets, and I have some sculptures from there. So there's a lot of effort to heal by getting rid of the initial conditions.
Now, they had a truth and reconciliation courts after the genocide?
Yes, they're called Gachacha, and uh-huh, those ended, I think it was this year, but it may have been last year that the Gachacha ended.
Mm-hmm.
And the results were mixed. It was a chance for those lesser genocidaires to admit their crimes and to ask for forgiveness. And I think when those admissions and those requests came sincerely from the heart, that they were granted. But I think, well, not I think, there were many cases where those admissions were given so that the people could get out of jail. And so there are still, you know, and you have, it's interesting, two articles came out with very different conclusions at the same time. One was in the New Yorker by Philip Gurevich, who wrote, "We wish to inform you that tomorrow we will be killed with our families," which is the first nonfiction book that I read about Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
And that came out in the New Yorker, and it was very positive, and it talked about the reconciliation. And he, Gurevich, has since written a few articles. This is a wonderful story because they have now a world-class cycling team in Rwanda, which was started by this professional cyclist, Doc Boyer.
Uh-huh.
And that is such a beautiful story because here you have these people, and really, you know, when you train with someone, it's such a bond. And I think this is the kind of thing where true reconciliation really happens. Because you have Hutu and Tutsi training together, sweating together, suffering together, and triumphing together. And this is where you really get beyond those differences between Hutu and Tutsi.
There's a couple scenes in the novel where you're actually sort of the use of athletics for political, you know, whatever expediency or I'm not sure what the exact word would be, but you know, just political gain, and those were very interesting scenes in the book. I mean, politics does always play a large role in sport and vice versa.
Yes, yeah, the Olympics is certainly not non-political.
Well, but you said with the cycling team, this is sort of, you know, kind of like, I don't know, the rugby team of South Africa or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, where this could be a binder.
Yes, I'm waiting for the movie.
Well, the book is really interesting, Running the Rift, a novel set against the Rwandan genocide. Naomi Benaron, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Naomi Benaron speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her book, Running the Rift, won the 2011 Bellwether Prize for Socially Engaged Fiction, and it's just out in softcover. It came out in October, and I spoke with her back in December here on Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.